the dawning of the modern media coverage and governmental conversation around UFOs, which was around 2017, with the New York Times coming out with that front page article. Within less than 24 hours, Leslie Kane and Ralph Blumenthal from the New York Times were contacting us and asking us if we could take the story down. Getting connected to people and being flown out to America to like sit down with CIA officers and stuff, and it all happened very quickly. Suddenly got like, you know, like thrown into a world of spooks and spies and all these weird dudes, and now I don't know what to think about any of it. Now, although Gary Nolan wasn't officially a part of Greer's team, he was completely linked up with Greer for a number of years. He was doing the Atacama Humanoid, which I still have questions about that. I don't think that this is conclusive, and I think that there was probably some smudging of the data on the Atacama Humanoid, quite frankly. Now, you could say disclosure's already happened, just because official institutions have acknowledged that there is a reality to things that are unidentified and they're flying and they're objects and we don't know what they are. That, to me, is part of the smokescreen. We agree that UFOs are there. My God, yeah, no, they are, aren't they? We're just as confused as you are. It's like, no, I don't buy that for one second. I know you know more. Could be a drastic a high national security threat situation that would necessitate the revealing of exotic next generation technology. You know, he's obsessed with genetics, he's obsessed with high energy physics, he's getting all of these different scientists from different areas. And what Eric was saying was he felt like this is a man who's collecting ingredients for some master chef, and you know, this is someone else in the background. As I said to Joe Rogan, you're essentially walking into, you know, the lion's den, like the absolute kind of central core of, you know, we're talking Lockheed Martin, we're talking like the tier one contractor, spearhead defense contractor of the US government, and we're talking the Skunk Works, like, you know, the classified experimental program. So this is the deepest element of the Black Projects. I talked about this on Joe Rogan, and I've talked about it many times on my own podcast, that there was a bit of a synchronistic step-by-step build-up process towards me having my experiences with what I had, which was in particular orbs of light, these orange orbs of light. And there's a lot of people who have a knee-jerk reaction to not just the UFO subject, that's already controversial, but within the UFO subject, the claim that you're able to have contact, that you're able to initiate some form of contact, that you yourself can be the responsible party for a communication of some form. This is a very controversial kind of subcategory of the UFO subject that even people who are really into UFOs will look at and go, you know, I'm not sure about that. So for me, it was introduced to me in quite an organic way. I was already doing a lot of research into consciousness and philosophy and metaphysics and biophysics and quantum mechanics, all at a very layman level. I don't claim to be any sort of professional or expert in these sciences, but connecting dots with what I genuinely believed was true about reality, which is that reality is ultimately conscious, that consciousness itself is a fundamental substrate of reality, and that we are, like nodes or points on a network, and that we are just kind of antennas or receivers or, you know, complex conduits for this consciousness. And I was looking for evidentiary pathways in different research avenues, whether it was in mysticism or in science, to try and like bridge the gap and bring these things together, which is ultimately why I call Project Unity. And, you know, people misconstrued that all the time because I'm still a relatively young, quite fiery man, so I kind of get a little bit annoyed at people sometimes, and they're like, oh, so much for unity. And it's like, look, I mean, I get it, but that's not actually what it's about. It's a bit more kind of metaphysical and fundamental. That it's more about a unification between spirit and science on a very fundamental level. You know, I'm still a human being, and I'm going to act like a human being, and that's just the way it is. You know, we're all, faults and all. It was very important to me at the time when I was doing all of this different research before I'd had any contact experiences to try and build up this picture of reality. But it got to a point where, honestly, I'd been doing a lot of research, all these different avenues, various subjects, and it started to build up to a depression because I had a feeling within me that I had been collecting all this information, and it all sounds so important, and, you know, big ideas about consciousness and death and reality, and, you know, all of these, you know, big metaphysical and kind of existential questions, and searching for that. And it's enjoyable for a while, but it's funny, like almost every mystery school and almost every religion in some element will talk about how the path to seeking knowledge is the path to madness or the path to pain, because it actually is. The more you accumulate things, the more you begin to understand about reality, it can become quite painful, especially because most people are not trying to do that. So you become very alienated and cut off from the rest of the world until you find your tribe, right? Until you actually find your people. But so for me, it got to a point where I was just feeling really quite like overwhelmed. And I was like, well, if all of this is real, if these ideas about consciousness and, you know, universal consciousness and life after death and non-human intelligence, if all of this is real, I want to experience something in life that actually gives me a sense of it being real, not just information. I want to experience something. And so I had a moment, you know, you could call it a prayer, I guess, but for me, it was just sitting on my bed one night and just talking out loud to the universe, kind of having a little moment and just saying, look, I do think that these things are real, and I've got like a real intuition that this is what I should be researching and studying, but I need something that actually is happening in life, something that I can see, something that I can actually experience that validates all of this. Like, I actually feel like I need that now, and I want that, and I'm ready. So, you know, give me something like that, please give me something like that. And so I made that request, and I think about a week went by, and then my friend, he was like, oh, I've been watching this documentary and I think you'll really enjoy it. You should check it out. And I was like, okay, what is it? He said, it's called Unacknowledged by Dr. Stephen Greer. Now, at this point, didn't know who Stephen Greer was. I wasn't in the UFO subject whatsoever. I'd maybe seen a couple of little documentaries here and there, but it wasn't something that was in my mind at any point, really. Even when I was doing the like esoteric research and, you know, UFOs just didn't really figure into it. So I wasn't already biased towards it in any way. We watched the documentary, and, you know, as much as Stephen Greer is a polarizing figure within the UFO community, some people love him, some people hate him. For me, I kind of take it bits and pieces with everyone, you know, especially when it comes to UFO personalities. And I suppose people might call me a UFO personality, and I'd say take everything I say with a little pinch. Like, whatever you genuinely think is legit and what your intuition is saying to you is real, then you should just roll with that. So I'm not here to, you know, preach in any way, but Stephen Greer was like, you know, introduced to me through this documentary, which is a brilliant documentary. It's one of the better ones he did, actually. I did enjoy the Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind documentary he did, which was all kind of geared towards the CE5 contact. But Unacknowledged was a good one to, I mean, even now I would look back and say, oh, well, a couple of the people in that, I'm kind of like, not quite sure if I trust you anymore. But from like an introductory standpoint, it was a really good doc to watch because it made it feel very legitimate. All of these, you know, missile launch officers and intelligence guys, and they're all speaking very seriously about it. And, you know, some very legitimate testimonies, actually. And we have to take our hat and tip it to Greer for doing the 2001 National Press Conference, because that was one of the first major, major pushes towards disclosure that unfortunately got overlooked by the tragic events of 9/11, which happened not long afterwards. Now, I don't necessarily agree with Greer when he's like, I think they did that to overshadow my conference, because that's the kind of madness that people get to in this world of, like, you know, ego and like imagining things are all happening because of them. Again, pinch of salt, take things as, you know, as you kind of come to them. So that's where I'd kind of go, all right, that's where my barricade comes up when you start saying things like that. Nevertheless, very interesting man. Brilliant research. He brought together a huge conference full of these whistleblowers, and that was part of this documentary. I'm just going to take a quick break and drink my coffee. I do talk very fast. Undiagnosed ADHD, for sure. Yeah, so this documentary, Unacknowledged by Stephen Greer, was my first introduction into the UFO subject. And because I'd been on my bed the week prior saying to the universe, I need a sign, I want something that connects and makes these, you know, high ideas about consciousness more real and more tangible, give me something real. And the documentary essentially ends with him talking about CE5, this Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, the idea that you can initiate a form of contact yourself through the medium of consciousness and you know, meditative consciousness and projecting intention. Now, if I heard that without making this request on my bed the week prior, maybe this would have just glazed right over and I'd have been like, oh, that's a crazy idea. Maybe that's true. But because I'd made that request, this really did feel like the moment he started talking about it, my brain went straight to that, you know, moment on my bed. And I was like, oh shit. Like, I think this actually is the answer I've been trying to get. And here's a guy telling me that all of these things that I've been trying to learn about consciousness and meditative mind can be applied to actually gaining some form of evidence through an experience with some form of intelligence. Now, you know, Stephen Greer will argue all the way pretty much that these are peaceful entities, and maybe they are. Like, I didn't have any negative, events other than the mark that appeared on my arm, which is, you know, it's weird, and I still don't know what to think about that. And a lot of people have said that you should have like some form of hypnotic, you know, regression therapy, and you know, maybe I should. I guess there's like a little part of me that's like, fuck, man, like, you know, if that turned out to be something I didn't want to know, like, that would really suck. But at face value, my experiences were just incredibly profound and you know, enlightening, to the extent that it was a confirmatory event for the request I've been making. So I'd like, you know, to cut a long story short, when I was watching that documentary and got inspired by what Greer was talking about, I started going out into my garden every night and started to, you know, look up at the stars and breathe. And I'm not a meditative practitioner. That's what really inspired me most of all, to pick up a camera and put it on a tree branch and say hello to the world and say I had these experiences. Because I was like, well, damn, man, like, you know, if I can do this, you know, I'm not an idiot, but I'm not a practitioner of yogi meditation or anything. Like, I'm not ready for that type of spiritual enlightenment, and yet I could have these experiences. So surely most people, if not everyone, can have these experiences. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, it all started off essentially Project Unity with me having these extremely vivid and profound experiences with orange orbs of light, including this one event where they did actually come down from the sky, three of them, and hover about, you know, 3 feet over the roof of my house back in 2019 in August. And you know, to this day, I have no idea what they are. I've done a lot of research into the various ideas. I kind of lean maybe towards a form of sentient plasma, self-organized plasma, but I'm not 100% sure. But yeah, that's what really started me. And obviously, I've gone down various avenues. I'm not a one-man band in my own mind. I don't just obsess over one subject. I like all these different mysteries in the world and in reality, and you know, even into, you know, what's going on in the modern conspiracies, in modern politics, and you know, the modern institutions. So I like to do a lot of different explorations into research, but my core, my foundation, the kind of, you know, the pillar upon which the Project Unity was built, was personal experiences with the unknown through the medium of consciousness, which to me is like the most profound thing that anyone could ever experience. Because at least from my perspective, when I had these experiences, it was confirmation that consciousness itself, I mean, how else were the, if I was thinking that I wanted these things to turn up, if I was truly thinking I want them to turn up and they turn up, then my thoughts were somehow traveling through the mediums of energy that comprise the universe. And therefore, consciousness isn't just generated by the brain as like default. Like, I know I can't prove with video and I can't prove definitively that these experiences happened, but if you do believe me, then what happened essentially does prove that consciousness is non-local, consciousness is universal. And that was enough for me. Now, you know, I've done a lot of attempts to have experiences again, and I have had weird experiences, and I've taken friends out and they've seen weird stuff as well. Even people who are not involved in this subject, they've gone, okay, I've never seen anything like that. Like, what exactly was that? It's like, I don't know. Well, like, we don't really know, right? It's like, holy shit. Like, they actually do see these things, but I never saw the orbs again. And then I suddenly got like, you know, like thrown into a world of spooks and spies and all these weird dudes. And now I don't know what to think about any of it, but you know, that's how it started. I also wasn't afraid. I was just kind of like rooted in place. Like, I was stuck in place, and I was shocked each time. But I wasn't afraid. It was honestly, I would say like bewilderment or amazement, just like, you know what I mean? Like, just staring. And this is another thing, is like, you know, first of all, I wasn't doing any of this for anyone else. Like, I wasn't doing this to gain evidence. I wasn't setting up multi-spectrum cameras and like, you know, all of that kind of stuff. That wasn't even in my mind. This was actually a very spiritual thing. Like, it was a personal spiritual engaging with the universe and having responses and going out each night wondering, my gosh, is it, you know, like, is it going to happen again? Like, what is going to happen this time? And so, and obviously, you know, you're looking up at the sky and you're trying to get into a state of mind Which is very different from your default, normal, waking, working state of mind. It's a very relaxed and sublime state, which a lot of us struggle to get into because we're in a world that's just completely populated with noise and you know, saturated with information and a bip, 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 bip constantly, right? So it's very difficult for the mind to stop chattering, chitter, chitter, chatter. And so meditation slows that down. Like meditation, you know, as a practice, slows down that chittering, chattering mind. And so I was having, like, you know, these moments of very clear consciousness, but this is a state of mind that, you know, it's not something where you can just grab a phone and break that state of mind and then start filming the sky. And so, like, when I did try to start capturing evidence after I had these orb experiences, you know, I'd be out there, and first of all, you're already breaking the necessary thought path. I know that it sounds like an excuse to a lot of the skeptics, and I get it. I do understand, like, it does sound like a bit of an excuse, like, oh, you don't want to break the magic thread, right, Jay? Like, you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, like, to a skeptic, I get it. I do get it. But they're fucking wrong. Like, you know, at the end of the day, like, it's completely real, and you do have to be in a very subtle state of mind. So if you suddenly, like, break that state of mind by getting on a phone, it's not going to work. And, you know, people have captured video of it. You can leave a camera passively recording the sky and stuff like that. But what I found most of all is that when I was trying to go out and capture evidence of it, I'd be looking up and I'd be calming my mind. And then I'd be thinking more about the fact that it's filming. And I'd be like, come on, like, oh, come on, something turn up. And then you're not even in the state of mind. You've actually left it because now you're expecting things. Now you're kind of being in the ego. You're actually more in the ego because you want proof. So it's weird. It's spiritual. I do think it's some form of, like, you know, kind of like spiritual domain you're crossing into, like astral, ethereal, but also maybe explainable through some form of plasma phenomena. Like I said, I am interested in that potential idea that you're producing excess electromagnetic energy, and maybe that there's something that is attracted to electromagnetic energy. It could be as simple as that and not some, like, deep spiritual revelation, or it could be. We don't know. We just don't know. I think anything critical being revealed in terms of, like, technology or anything like that, reverse engineered technology, that will probably, if it ever came through, it'd come through the channel of national security necessity. So the unveiling of a weapon for a reason that currently is not needed. But if at that point, you know, let's say nuclear war, we might see an unveiling, a sudden revealing of technology that's taking things out in the sky that we'd never known. And then they go, yep, that was, you know, something that we had up our sleeve the whole time. So, like, you know, it could be a drastic kind of, you know, a high national security threat situation that would necessitate the revealing of exotic next generation technology. But when it comes to, I mean, I'll reiterate what I said on Joe Rogan, essentially, with the dawning of the modern media coverage and governmental conversation around UFOs, which was around 2017, with the New York Times coming out with that front page article, I think it was called Black Money and Glowing Auras or something like that, the Pentagon's classified program. And this was the, you know, the big revelation through Lou Elizondo that there was this advanced aerospace threat identification program that was looking at UFOs, and the Secretary of Defense wasn't being briefed on it. And when Lou Elizondo, the apparent claimed director of ATIP, said that he found out that the SecDef wasn't being briefed on it, he resigned in protest and went to the New York Times with the story about ATIP, and, you know, the ball starts rolling. There's a little bit more of a backstory to that, and it comes through Tom DeLonge, Blink-182 rock star Tom DeLonge, the most unlikely of candidates for, you know, starting some sort of UFO disclosure through the Pentagon and the DOD. But there you have it. You know, we live in such a weird world, and it is a rock star that began the entire ball rolling on modern UFO disclosure, if you want to call it that, although I don't have a whole lot of faith in this being a real disclosure pathway. Disclosure in terms of what exactly as well, because, you know, people use that word to kind of cover all sorts of weirdness. Like, what does disclosure actually mean? And different people have different terminologies for that. So, you know, you could say disclosure's already happened just because official institutions have acknowledged that there is a reality to things that are unidentified and they're flying and they're objects and we don't know what they are. That to me is part of the smokescreen. One sec. I think I've got a bit of a cold creeping up or something. Something's catching my throat. It's just the NSA beaming a signal into my yeah, just Lou Elizondo remote viewing my my esophagus right now. Tom DeLonge basically, you know, beginning this entire conversation. So he was talking about this before he went on Joe Rogan prior to 2017. Prior to Joe Rogan, he was on like Fade to Black with Jimmy Church, Jimmy Church's podcast. And he was talking about, you know, I've got all these advisors, I've got all these Pentagon DOD advisors and people that are going to be bringing out the UFO truth. And he said in his 2015 interview, 2016 on Fade to Black, that he'd been invited by a friend, because Tom DeLonge, for anyone who didn't know, is obsessed with the UFO subject. And he has been all the way through his professional career as a musician. And for anyone who doesn't actually know who Tom DeLonge is, he's a very successful musician, Blink-182, kind of like punk rock, skater rock. I used to listen to them when I was like, you know, 14, 15 on Kerrang music channel and stuff. Like, you know, it's kind of wild when he first came out on the stage. I was like, dude, that's the guy who used to listen to music. And he's out here like talking about, you know, disclosure of UFOs. But yeah, so, you know, he described this situation where a friend of his who worked at Lockheed Martin phoned him up and was like, hey, we're having a, you know, family and friends meet and greet at Lockheed Martin, and would you like to come and introduce the bosses onto the stage? Now, clearly at this point, because Tom DeLonge at this point was already linked up with Stephen Greer, he was good friends with Stephen Greer for quite a while. He went out and camped outside Area 51 with Stephen Greer and apparently had an anomalous experience with all these voices chattering around them in the desert night when they were in their tent. But he was like, you know, holding on to a lot of the tapes of the whistleblowers that Greer had recorded. There's a video of Tom back in the day showing people in his house, and he's got this like big library of books, and he's got like, you know, the architecture on Mars and the Freemason design of Washington. He's like, you know, like Washington is all designed by Freemasons, you know, Mars is like, he's like bringing all these books down. And then he's like, you know, and up here I've got like about 50 witness tapes from this guy who's going to be bringing out UFO disclosure. And it's like, oh, so that's Stephen Greer, obviously. He's the only person that had all these, you know, 50 witnesses. So they were clicked up. And even Greer said that, like, he, you know, went backstage with his daughter to Blink-182 VIP and was, you know, homies with Tom DeLonge. So they were tight. And then Tom DeLonge has this idea. He has this idea to the Stars Academy of Arts and Science, this kind of platform to begin a public discussion and kind of open pathways for the government to begin disclosing information in a way that's curated, in a way that's managed. And he described this to the people at Lockheed Martin. So he went and he did, you know, speak to the bosses on stage and introduce the bosses on stage at this meet and greet. But he said to his friend on the phone that he'd only do that if he could have 10 minutes, 15 minutes with the bosses after the show. And he was, you know, his friend's like, okay, like, all right. I had no idea what he wanted to do. And he actually describes, like, he describes being led through corridors, playing white noise on speakerphones, like all static white noise and armed guards and, like, you know, various doors, and they, you know, talking all these layers of security, and ends up in this room with all of the bosses, the Skunk Works, all these guys at Lockheed Martin. And he pitches to the Stars Academy of Arts and Science. And he essentially, and he said this multiple times on Fade to Black, that he went in there, he was like, you know, with these guys, you've got to go in, you've got to be of service. You've got to want to be of service. And that's how I approached it. I approached it as I wanted to be of service to these people. And, you know, as I said to Joe Rogan, you're essentially walking into, you know, the lion's den, like the absolute kind of central core of, you know, we're talking Lockheed Martin, we're talking like the tier one contractor, spearhead defense contractor of the US government, and we're talking the Skunk Works, like, you know, the classified experimental program. So this is the deepest element of the Black Projects. And he's just there like, I'm happy for you to take control. I've just got a little bit of a template here, and I'm a really famous rock star, so I can kind of get this message out there to the youth of today. And the reason why I think they actually took this bait and took this option is because of Stephen Greer. I think if Stephen Greer didn't exist, if there wasn't someone out there, and I'm not saying Greer's right, but he was out there getting millions and millions of views on Netflix, like number one, Unacknowledged was like number one on Netflix for like months and months. Like, it was getting a ton of views. So a lot of people are being exposed to a narrative where it's illegal programs, it's, you know, anti-congressional, anti-institutional, and it needs to be legally looked at. People need to go to jail. And that's kind of how Greer is positing it, is that this is a criminal cover-up that's held humanity back for about a century. So that's like, you know, extreme, like, we don't want someone like this going out there. From the perspective of these guys at Lockheed, it's like, you know, this Greer guy is out there raising hell, and maybe there will be investigations, maybe there will be audits from the government if he convinces enough people. I mean, look, he's already talking to CIA directors, and the Clintons are friends with him. Like, I wonder if those conversations were happening by people in the know who really did know about these programs, and were, because he was the only guy. Like, yes, there are a lot of ufologists, but Greer was the only one that managed to kind of capture the online viral media and actually start to propagate into the wider world. So if there is a reality to the things that Greer is saying, whew, he's a risk. And then suddenly it's like, you know, well, what do you do about that? There's no real option. We are people in the deepest elements of the national security state. We don't even exist on paper. How are we supposed to combat someone in the public who's doing this? You know what I mean? Unless we, you know, we do that. And there's potential that that was attempted. I mean, there's people on Greer's team that died from a very aggressive form of what they claim was electronically induced cancer. There's quite a few people on Greer's team that have died in that way. And Greer claims that, you know, someone, I think, offered him $1 billion at a party, like an Air Force general. Who knows if that's true? I don't know if it's true. But if, you know, these are the methods being used, he was clearly an issue to them. So they didn't really have a viable method of combating that. And then again, Tom DeLonge walks into the situation, you know, and suddenly you've got this conduit, you've got this channel into the wider demographic, into the youth of today, and he's not even trying to boss us around. He's literally saying, I'll be the media face of this, but here's my template, you do with it what you will. And then suddenly, boom, Lou Elizondo, Christopher Mellon, like all these guys rush in, the New York Times gets activated. You know, how easy is it to get a New York Times story, a front page New York Times story on UFOs? I mean, come on, this never happens, right? And I have to say, like, you know, as the rose-tinted glasses, in a sense, have kind of come away, and I'm looking at it a bit more critically and without the bias that, you know, because when this all started, I'm a UFO experiencer, I've had orbs, you know, all these things, I'm ready to believe, I'm fully ready. So I'm like, wow, oh my God. And because it happened in the same time period as my orb experiences, I'm like, holy shit, this is a synchronicity, this is a message from the universe, the whole world is waking up with me, you know what I mean? I was like, this is crazy. So I was really ready to jump in and believe him. I was one of the first to interview Lou Elizondo. I kind of cringe at that interview now because I'm like glazing the shit out of him. You know, this is before we found out that he was the torture czar of Guantanamo Bay and all this. But yeah, you know, these guys all come onto the scene, and they have a very different method of approach to Stephen Greer. They have a very different narrative to Stephen Greer. And again, I'm not arguing that Greer is completely right, but what we have to look at is just the basic facts. There's one guy who's got a narrative that's very problematic for the national security state. He's the one guy that's out there causing noise. Then suddenly he's overtaken by a governmentally propped up, governmentally supported group of people who actually poach members from his team, people that were on Greer's actual disclosure project team, moved over to the Stars Academy of Arts and Science. Now, although Gary Nolan wasn't officially a part of Greer's team, he was completely linked up with Greer for a number of years. He was doing the Atacama humanoid, which I still have questions about that. I don't think that this is conclusive. And I think that there was probably some smudging of the data on the Atacama humanoid, quite frankly. But, you know, we can maybe get into that. But either way, there was a poaching from Greer's team. They all came onto Two Stars Academy, and this became the de facto, you know, conversation starter and maker for UFOs. So Greer, as much as he'd probably hate to hear this if he listened, got left in the dust a bit. And he did. He did get left in the dust a bit. And so I think when it comes to the modern UFO conversation, one of the issues I have with it more than anything, really, is this pushing of the idea from, not from your average Joe, but from within the deepest elements of the you know, national security architecture. Oh, we don't know what they are either. We agree the UFOs are there. My God, yeah, no, they are, aren't they? We're just as confused as you are. It's like, no, I don't buy that for one second. I know you know more. You might not know everything, but you 100% know a hell of a lot more than we do. And you've had all of these years since Nikola Tesla, since T. Townsend Brown, of looking into the energy, physics, and propulsion methodologies that might represent what these things are doing. And so don't tell me that you haven't created anything either, because I know you have. And so that's where I have a big problem with the modern narrative, is that, yes, a conversation is being started on UFOs. And yeah, I can sit my grandma or granddad or someone else in my family who's disconnected from this and say, well, you know, Christopher Mellon, the secretary, assistant sec def of defense, and Lou Elizondo, and he's got, and they'll be like, whoa, so Stanford and the Department of Defense is like, yes, it's a Pentagon. And it convinces them. So that's, you know, one of the ways that people have justified this. It's like, well, like it's starting a conversation. Yes, absolutely. But if it's starting a conversation off of a false pretense, it's a problem. And if the false pretense is, oh, we just don't know what they are, like, I've got an issue with that. So I started calling this out, and then suddenly, you know, after a few years of people being like, Jay, you know, great interview, amazing interview. Oh, Lou Elizondo, oh, he's got Gary Nolan on. Oh, he's the first to get Ross on, the first to get Tim Burchett on, first to get Admiral Tim Gallaudet on. And then suddenly I was hated by so many people because I started going, hang on a second. Like, these guys are fucking around. Like, they're spinning some sort of narrative here. And you very quickly encounter that there is a bit of a cult. And that's where I kind of like came up against a solid wall in ufology and started backing away, going, I don't like this. I don't like being told how I need to think and how I need to talk. And especially when it comes to trusting government stooges who have been essentially deployed into the community to begin narrative changing. Like, when you start noticing that, it's a problem. And so, yeah, like, you know, a few of us early on, Tupacabra and Red Panda as well on X, and a few others in terms of like my kind of close group of associates online, we were all quietly saying these things and being like, fuck, man, like, when are people going to click onto this? And then it's kind of changed. Now a lot of people are very doubtful of these guys for good reasons, but it's been a pretty slow journey towards kind of getting people on board with that, because again, you know, we want to believe, right? I mean, it's like and I think even that's propaganda, you know, the flying saucer and the I want to believe. Like, this has been pushed so much, and it's like, I don't want to believe, I want to know. I want to know, not believe. I think that's one of the issues, is that the intelligence community preys on our beliefs, and they create this vast spaghetti junction of different beliefs, and everyone's combating and fighting over them. And it's not about knowledge, it's about confirming your bias and your belief. And you know, we encounter that a lot in the UFO community. And that was a big problem for me, because so many people want to believe in these guys. They want to believe in Tudor Stars Academy. And so did I for a while. And then you have to start being logical and you know, rational, and sometimes that means going against what you want it to be. Yeah, we all want it to be legit, but I'm afraid if it's not legit, we have to talk about it. It's not, you're not an enemy, you're not an enemy for doing that, you know, as much as people would like to paint you as one.
The main proponent of the time travel hypothesis for the alien greys is Dr. Michael P. Masters. I've had him on a couple of times for interviews. He's written a few books on the idea. He's an anthropologist, and so he looks at it from the perspective of human physiology changing over, you know, exposure to certain environments or exposure to certain lengths of time, different planetary environments could cause these types of changes over time. I do wonder, I mean, I don't know, obviously, if they are time traveling. I do think that it's complex, and a lot of physicists really hate time travel as a concept in general, and I'm not a physicist enough to even begin to say that, oh yeah, like that's definitely what's happening. But at the same time, I'll leave space for it as a possibility. I also lean towards an idea that perhaps these alien greys are primarily subterranean based species on this planet. And I only say that because there are a few ancient references across the world to beings that are very similar in description to the alien grey. The Hopi tribe, they have the mythos of the ant people. And what's weird about the ant people and the Hopis is that they actually describe these beings as not only underground dwelling beings that look like ants, but that they also came during times of great cataclysm and helped these people survive underground, the humans, the Hopi tribe ancestors, and then helped them resurface and taught them agriculture and taught them civilization building. So it's like, well, okay, hang on a second, you know, is this the alien greys? Is this an advanced subterranean species? Because, you know, you think about kind of like an analog in nature that's comparable. Think about the mycelium network, the fungal network that spreads across the entire planet. Now, that chose a subterranean developmental pathway to evolve. It chose to go underground as an evolutionary dynamic. And what happened from that is it survived great cataclysms that happened on the surface, right? So all of the flora and fauna that got destroyed by various cataclysmic cycles on this planet, one of the things that managed to thrive and continue and might be
a very intelligent elder of this planet is the mycelium network that spreads across it, right? This fungal network. And very interesting that various nodes appear on this network that when human beings consume them can completely change their sense of awareness and perception and give them spiritual awareness and revelation. So that's definitely something to consider when discussing, you know, conscious mind of the planet. But at the same time, what if a human species or a hominid, some type of hominid species, chose to survive underground? And maybe they thrived underground, and maybe they survived underground when we didn't, and we were destroyed on the surface. The use of natural resonance in caverns. Now, this is something that I'm interested in from the prehistoric period in terms of acoustic engineering that we see in ancient megalithic sites. And I think a lot of that, in terms of the deliberate acoustic engineering that seems to be geared towards exciting the mind into certain states of consciousness, certain expanded meditative states of consciousness. This is a proven thing in various megalithic sites across the world. I think that started from natural caverns, limestone caves that have a natural resonance to them. And when we went into these caves, we actually felt, you know, a change in state from this resonance. And there's an interesting correlation with that. And I am going to get back to the grays, but this is kind of related. It's an interesting correlation that we actually, there were a few studies done on the concentration of prehistoric cave art based on the resonance of the cave itself. And so the more resonant the cave, the more acoustically resonant the cave, the more artwork that was appearing on the cave. And the deeper they went into the cave, the more resonance, the more artwork was appearing. So it seems that there was a connection between early human consciousness, acoustics, and an expansion of mind that wanted to make them paint the walls with swirling patterns like we see in the Hypogeum in Malta and in, you know, various other prehistoric sites, these swirling patterns. So I think that acoustics plays a role in potentially opening the mind towards what we could call telepathy. Now, a lot of these alien greys are supposed to be telepathic. So if they did grow up and evolve within these caverns of natural resonant limestone and it's echoing, they might have naturally evolved sensory abilities that we haven't. So I leave space for the idea that maybe the greys are a subterranean species that's living on this planet. You know, the fact that we see so many orbs going in and out of volcanoes, in and out of mountains. You know, we have native stories of sacred cities below the earth. Like, who knows? Maybe we're so ignorant to what's beneath our feet. So yeah, I apply that kind of logic to it as well. And maybe there's, you know, space for this. But yeah, I find the alien greys a very fascinating element of the UFO conversation because it does have intersections into ancient history. And another interesting example is the, I've said this a couple of times, the Amazonian tribe that was on this podcast a few years back. And when they were speaking to these tribesmen who were like legit from the Amazon jungle and only spoke their tribal language, and they had a translator on the podcast with them, and they were in their natural headdress and, like, you know, all fully tribal. And, you know, they were asking, the podcast hosts were asking them about aliens, and they didn't know what they meant when he said aliens, and they were trying to figure out a way to describe what they meant. And so he started thumbing through a magazine, and he shows them a picture of an alien gray, and this tribal chieftain goes, "That's Makanwabu, Makanwabu." And like the other one's like, "Yes, Makanwabu." It's like, whoa, you know, and they have an entire mythos about this thing called Makanwabu, which is a man that became an ant, and it lives underground, and it can steal your soul, and it can appear in what they call the divine light of Mishipan, which I suppose is just their perspective of, like, the, you know, divine light of God. And so it can appear in their perspective in the divine light of God, but it's a trickster, and you have to be very careful with this. And if you know, if it takes your soul, you need a very good shaman to bring your soul back. And they were being like, you know, this fucking thing is serious. Like, you don't want to mess around. Us Westerners are just out here like, you know, whoosh, it's an alien gray. And they're just like, don't fuck around with these things, dude. Like, you're going to need a shaman. And none of you are shamans. You don't know what to do. You'll be lost. You know, we'll call it schizophrenia in the modern world, but they would just be like, this motherfucker needs a shaman right now. But yeah, like, you know, there's so many various stories around the ancient times across cultures that seem to relate to the same archetype as the Hollywood alien gray. And that's surprising to a lot of people. They think it just came around in the 1950s, flying saucer frenzy. It's like, no, there's weird historical, you know, reference to this. So yeah, it's something I would never say that I have any sort of understanding on in terms of what they are, but I do think the greys are real. I just don't know what they are. Eric Weinstein said something quite interesting recently, where he said it appears like, this is not verbatim, but he said something along the lines of it appears like Epstein was collecting ingredients for a master chef that's not him. He's not the master chef. He is a prop up. He's been made. He's superficial. He's not real. He's a cutout. And that's what Weinstein was really confused about, was like, this guy doesn't have the right knowledge, the right way to be living the life he lives. And so he's also collecting, you know, he's obsessed with genetics, he's obsessed with high energy physics, he's getting all of these different scientists from different areas. And what Eric was saying was he felt like this is a man who's collecting ingredients for some master chef, and it, you know, this is someone else in the background. And I think it probably does connect into the same type of idea that in the 1940s, 1950s, this was all CIA, United States Air Force, Wright-Patterson Air Force, but, you know, it was all very centralized and governmentally managed. And then at some point during the Cold War, this all splintered off into private aerospace and private groups that had access to extremely profound technology. And so the idea, and this is something that Greer has, you know, fought tooth and nail to put out there as a message as well, is that there is a transnational group. There is a group that is completely beyond government, completely beyond nation states and any sort of, you know, like kind of congressional action. No, these are people that are separate from all of that, and is connected into high finance, and is connected into high technology, and is connected into the black channels of trafficking, whether it's guns or drugs or humans or children. And so I think that you get into this kind of like shadow state above the national interests and above America, above the UK, and you know, with connections into these respective nodes, but without any sort of actual affiliation with government. And I think that's what we're dealing with. So when someone like Epstein comes along, this ingredient grabber for some master chef, it's like, okay, so these people who are the master chefs, they seem to be collecting knowledge on very interesting scientific avenues of exploration. And then you get into the recent, you know, spout of scientists and defense officials who have died, that have gone missing. You know, there's like 10 of these guys now. We can't say with certainty that everything's connected, but when you actually bring up a map of these people and the various institutions, they're all connected to each other in one way or another, especially General McCasland. Now, General McCasland's a very strange, you know, part of this whole story. But yeah, it likely isn't even about governmental disclosure anymore, because the governments aren't in control of the most important aspects of this anymore. Things are just going to get weirder and weirder until it gets so weird that everyone's going to have to talk about it. Even the, you know, the dumbest amongst us are going to have to raise their head up and go, what? It's getting so weird. Like, can we talk? And so I think that we're in that process now where things are just kind of getting so chaotic and bizarre and unpredictable. Everyone's just talking about it. No one trusts anything. And I think especially because we're in the era of AI, and AI is getting to a level now which is almost completely indistinguishable from reality in a lot of cases. I mean, there are so many times now where I'm scrolling through X and I see a really cool video and I'm like, whoa, that's really cool, and watch it for 10 seconds and I'm like, hang on a second, like, mountain goats can't run down a mountain like that, like, that's not real, you know. And it's just like people have lost faith in almost everything. And I said that like a year ago, is like we're entering into a post-consensus reality, a reality where there is not really a consensus anymore. There's not a general agreement. And that's basically about everything, from the fundamentals of biology, which we all disagree on now, to geopolitics, which everyone disagrees on now, to fundamental reality and consciousness and physics. And, you know, all of these things are going to change. And I think in some really interesting ways as well, some ways that we can't predict, especially in the realms of quantum physics and biophysics and the human body. These are areas I'm very interested in terms of research as well, because they provide some level of anchor into evidence and science for people when it comes to discussing consciousness as a universal medium, like we were talking about before. The way to actually kind of bridge the gap and connect and unify spirit and science is by providing science with a way of understanding spirit, right? Not debunking spirit, because that's what I think is really interesting, is the more we explore reality from a scientific perspective, the deeper and deeper we chip away at the kind of solid element of reality and discover that underneath that, it's all energy, and that energy seems to be weirdly responsive to the observer, right? On a quantum level, I think that we're getting to a point where we have to actually, from a scientific perspective, go, oh, you know, we don't want to say it's God, because we don't like that word, but it's starting to really look like God, you know. And it's like, I think we're getting there. I think that consciousness as an element of reality, fundamental, embedded and baked into the brickwork of reality itself, is going to become one of the big changes in society, because as technology evolves and as our understanding of reality evolves, the way people actually perceive reality will change as well. So we might be in the beginnings of a massive, massive shift. And if I look at my own life, and I think a lot of people can relate to this, if I look at my own life and I think of all of the times in my life which have been chaotic, which have been negative, which have been, you know, moments where you're sitting there going, this is never going to get better. Oh my God, this is crazy. This is the worst time. It always actually ends up when you look back a few years down the line, you look back and you go, I actually needed that. I needed that time. As much as I feel sorry for Jay in, you know, 2022 or whatever time, as much as I don't want to be there again, oh man, I now see that that was necessary to get to where I am now. And the same can be applied, and I think absolutely can be applied on the macro collective scale. You just look at the human collective as a single human being. It's going through phases, it's growing, it's evolving, and that can only come through obstacles and challenges being traversed. And instead of it being singular challenges, like your girlfriend just dumped you, or, you know, you lost your job or something like this, instead of it being a single thing, it's war, it's famine, it's governmental corruption, it's fucking demon pedophile networks running huge amounts of global infrastructure. It's realizing these things, and it feels nightmarish and it feels terrifying, and a lot of people don't want to deal with it. But that is the dark night of the soul. That is the trial. That is the moving through evolution and development. So I think that we're actually in a time of profound change and transformation, but that can only come through a lot of intense chaos and confusion. So, you know, we're in a very interesting time, like to be alive, to be here. It's nerve-wracking, and there's a lot of anxiety, but I also think that we're right on the precipice of potentially changing for the better as humanity. We seem to be very much at the beginnings of understanding our consciousness. And maybe this was something that happened to us. Maybe something I wonder about is, were we cataclysmically reset as a species? Were we at one point in the ancient past far more connected to consciousness, far more connected to spirit, very much understanding of these energies, not from a scientific point of view, not from a quantum biology and protons and neutrons, but from just an intuitive, genuine connection to reality and flow of information coming through you. You know, as someone who, you know, I'm a very creative person. I'm a guitarist. I've been a guitarist since I was like 8 years old. And, you know, there's like about 8 guitarists in my family on my mom's side. It seems to be in our blood, like all the men in the family play guitar. And for me, it's just like an intuitive thing. Like I'll just sit and play, and the best times, like the best music, the best sound is when my brain suddenly just turns off. I'm not even thinking, and it's just flowing. And that's the Akashic flow state, right? That's where you're tapping into information outside of the ego, outside of the id. Like your brain's kind of turning off and it's flowing in from somewhere that's more intuitive. And that happens with music, and it happens with art, and it happens with, you know, even when I'm doing my video editing and I'm feeling really creative and I can already see it in my mind and I'm just kind of building it when I'm editing, and I'm like, yes, you know, I get really inspired by it. And then people will comment and be like, that was so good. And I know that that's because it came from somewhere else. And frankly, not to sound like I'm, again, I don't want to sound like I'm some guru, because I'm not, but I can get into these flow states. And another one is writing. Like when I'm writing presentations or things like this for videos, and it's 2 o'clock in the morning and I've got an idea for something and I start writing it, and then suddenly 3-4 pages have happened and I'm barely even thinking, and I'm, you know, writing this all down, and then I'll record that. And all the time, those times are the ones where people comment the most, saying, that was so good. It really resonated with me. And for me, I look back at that and go, well, that's where, you know, my brain, 30, 31 year old, 28 year old, however old I was at these points, I'm 31 now, that brain wasn't responsible. I was taking a backseat to something greater coming through. And so it's not even about the ego. It's not about me being like, I can do this. it's something we're all capable of doing and doing it in different ways. You know, you could just be someone who makes pancakes so damn good because you just get into a flow state with it and nobody can top your pancakes. You know what I mean? It could be anything like that. And so I think our ancestors, our shamanic ancestors, were tapping into that kind of flow state at a way more profound level than we are. So it's not even necessarily that we're babies in the cosmos, but we've been reset into babies. We're the traumatized offspring generationally through thousands of years of civilizational growth now from the younger Dryas, from that time period of great destruction. All of these generations following on up to our current moment are traumatized. They've all been traumatized. So, you know, we're building off of that type of issue. And so, you know, maybe we're now facing our traumas in a more profound way, especially because we've created the internet. We can all look at ourselves. We can all really put the mirror up to humanity even more now. I mean, sometimes I hate seeing the things I see on my X feed, but it also reminds me of what's happening in the world. And you know, so we're at a very interesting time of the ability to self-reflect, but also in a very interesting time of ego and you know, competition. And these things are clashing. Again, when I had my contact experiences with the orbs, and from that point, and I think maybe even with lockdown, that afforded me the freedom, despite all the madness that was going on, it did afford me the freedom to do what I wanted to do each day during that time period. And obviously, at this point, I was a 9-to-5 worker as well. So, you know, I was then suddenly free for a bit. And after that, I never got a job again. Admittedly, like, you know, like when I was first starting Project Unity, I was broke. I was totally broke. I mean, I was on, like, you know, government benefits, like signed up for, I signed myself off of work with depression and anxiety, which was legit. Like, it was giving me depression and anxiety. I was working some terrible job, man. I was working in an insurance office. God. Whew. At this point in time, I was, I was struggling. I was struggling financially. It's only been over the last, I'd say, like, you know, two, three years that Project Unity is fully become like how I finance my life and how I live. And I'm so grateful for that. And, you know, wanted to keep growing. But yeah, like despite the fact that there was money struggles for sure, whilst I was just committing to Project Unity and, like, you know, getting interviews and getting videos, it was extremely intuitive. Like, things really did feel like they were just landing in front of me. And I just think that I was able to get out of my own way. I wasn't thinking about a plan B or C or D. I was like, this is what I'm going to do every given day. And again, lockdown kind of gave me the freedom to be able to play with that. Without that, maybe I wouldn't have been able to easily, you know, kind of get into this. But I had my orb experiences. I began making videos online, like really basic, just putting a video, a camera up on a tree branch and just saying to the world, like, you know, these are my experiences, is what I think about them. And people started commenting and subscribing, and it was, you know, dribbling in a bit. My actual big break was Richard Dolan. God bless him. I was watching him like every day. I still love Richard Dolan. I wish he would comment and critique the modern disclosure movement a bit more. I feel like he's backed away from that and doesn't want to do that. Well, you should do that, Richard. But he is a brilliant speaker, and I was listening to him all the time. And then he actually gave me a shout out. He gave me a shout out on the Eric Davis notes. You know, it's kind of like a big part of the modern ufology, is like this compilation of notes that came out through Dr. Edgar Mitchell's estate, the Apollo 14 astronauts. So Dr. Edgar Mitchell, when he died, all of his UFO research was just going to be thrown away by his family. His family didn't really care about all of that. And a friend stepped in and said, no, don't throw that away. Anything UFO related, give it to me. I'm really interested in that stuff. And through this transition of information being given to this guy, the notes came with that, because Dr. Edgar Mitchell, I know like, stay with me here because there's a lot of names, but Dr. Edgar Mitchell knew Dr. Eric Davis. He knew him very well. They were friends, and they worked on joint projects and stuff like this, right? So when he died and these papers came out, they stayed private for a while, and then they were kind of shared in a private UFO research group, and someone in that group put them online, and then they went everywhere, like, whoa, there's these documents from Eric Davis, and it's describing him meeting with a vice admiral who was like the 13th director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, like a really high up guy, Vice Admiral Thomas R. Wilson, and you know, describes this whole kind of like experience of him trying to find information and getting denied access. I did a lot of coverage and research on that, and that's what got Richard Dolan's attention. And he did like a little shout out saying, like, you know, this guy Project Unity is doing this stuff, and that kind of brought people over. And then my big break, really another big break, and these happened like consecutively after each other, was Richard Dolan linked me up to a very good researcher who doesn't have a public name. He's not a government guy. He just doesn't want to be known publicly. So on my YouTube channel way back, like 5 years back, there's a bunch of videos of a guy called Mr. X. Really interesting guy. Like, honestly, if you want to get deep into like the kind of like physics of exotic technology and the names in reverse engineering programs and stuff, this guy did incredible research. We did like a 3-hour breakdown on the Eric Davis notes with this guy. And within less than 24 hours, Leslie Kane and Ralph Blumenthal from the New York Times were contacting us and asking us if we could take the story down, because they were working on a story that was about the Eric Davis notes. And then they came across my video and were like, this dude's got receipts that we didn't even have. Like, this is like a lot of information. And so we started interfacing with Ralph Blumenthal and Leslie Kane for their story. Then that story came out and it was kind of like, you know, the editorial board tanked it, and it wasn't a very good story in terms of like, there wasn't any real information in it. But yeah, like, I had a few big breaks very early on, like Richard Dolan. And then, you know, I basically said to the to Leslie and Ralph from the New York Times, I'd be willing to take the video down, because they said, you know, would you be willing to take it down temporarily until our story comes out? And I was like, yeah, but I want to get the first interview with you when you do your story. You know, so I wanted to get, you know, at least something out of it. I'm not going to ask for money. I'm not like that, but I want to get something out of it. So I got the first interview when they put out the article. And that's why a lot of people were like, who the hell is this guy? Like, you know, he got the first, like, I suddenly had out of nowhere thousands of people watching that video, because obviously it's like the first interview of the New York Times people on UFOs. And so, like, that was my jumping off point. And I was very lucky. Like, I got connected to Ross Coulthart before anyone else. I got like Tim Burchett on before anyone else. Admiral Tim Gallaudet, John Ramirez. Like, there's a whole bunch of people that I got like exclusives and getting, you know, the first kind of story out. And I don't necessarily trust everyone I've had on my podcast, but, you know, that's just kind of the evolution of thought as you go through this over the years and you look back on certain things. But yeah, it was all very synchronistic. Like, I wasn't, like, a lot of people started going like, who is this guy? Like, you know, I bet he's like MI5. He's some British intelligence or something. And I'm just sitting here like, no, it's all just happening. Like, I know, I don't even know how it's happening. And, you know, getting connected to people and being flown out to America to like sit down with CIA officers and stuff. And this stuff, it all happened very quickly. And yeah, like naturally, synchronistically. And so I think I am meant to be doing what I'm doing, and I love doing what I'm doing. And essentially all I'm really doing is making public my own attempts to understand reality. I'm just trying to understand my own reality, and I'm making it slightly public while doing it.